Super sex.
Intercourse.
Condoms.
Sexually transmitted infections.
HIV.
STI.
HIV. Sexual health.
Jesus.
Treatment.
Prevention.
Condoms.
Sexual attraction.
Sexually transmitted infections.
Contraceptive.
Sex education.
Sexual health
specialist.
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the podcast. My name's Tom, my pronouns are he and him, and you're listening to the Sydney Sexual Health Centre podcast where we discuss all things related to sexual health. This podcast is being released on Transgender Day of Visibility 2024. In coming months, the Southeast Sydney Local Health District will launch a new clinic that services trans and gender diverse young people aged 16 to 25 living in the Greater Sydney area. I'm joined today by two nurses involved with Specialist Transgender Clinical Services. Maggie Smith is a transitional nurse practitioner at T150 at the Albion Centre. And Merrin Kelly is a CNC at the new clinic that will be opening shortly. We are here to discuss why these clinics are needed and what we can all do to make sure our services are welcoming for trans and gender diverse people. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Tom.
Can you tell me about yourselves and what led you to want to work in sexual health?
Sure. So, hey, Tom, Maggie, pronouns they, them. I got involved in first HIV nursing probably about 25 years ago when I was working the ward, and then moved from there to community health, where I really found my passion, which is sexual health. And the drive for that was always areas of inequity that had, especially then, a lot of stigma around it. And I just love and have a passion for providing equitable health care, and enjoy HIV and sexual health because you get to help people with areas of health that are often a bit still in medical professions taboo, that people are uncomfortable with, and affording people some comfort and dignity and education in that. And I find it really rewarding that in a very short amount of time you can help people with areas of their health that often they don't want to talk about, and just normalize it and give them that power. So that's how I got involved with it. And 25 years later, I'm still here, like a lifer in prison with sexual health.
And my name's Merrin. My pronouns are they or she. I started nursing like most people in the hospital system. And my experience there was really seeing the huge amounts of discrimination and marginalisation that lots of people who do have identities that are stigmatised were facing. And I found that really difficult to be a part of that system and to be seeing that happening every day. And I think I was drawn to work in sexual health because it's an area where the rights and, like Maggie said, like equity for a lot of these marginalized people are really front and center. And I think that's what initially drew me towards sexual health, as well as I think being a part of various communities and who do experience some of that discrimination, some of that exclusion in healthcare and in society. And I'd seen firsthand what people do experience in the healthcare system. So I wanted to be part of an area of health that is more welcoming of all people, but also where I felt like I could have more of an impact.
I guess more specifically from sexual health or HIV to trans health, and to just acknowledge straight up that transgender healthcare should not necessarily be aligned with sexual health. It doesn't mean there is an inherent sexual health problem, but it's kind of fitted nicely, certainly within the public sector, we can provide care. I first started working in the trans community when I went to the sexual health service, so over 20 years ago, and started back then pap smears, like cervical screening for trans guys, was this area that just wasn't even talked about then, and was lucky enough to get involved in community and then learn more and more about the trans community. Now identifying as non-binary, I realized it was probably some personal interest I was unaware of at the time. But realizing, as Merrin said, like that equity and access and being able to bring about a change in HIV and sexual health, but then realizing the trans community and the health barriers and just back then lack of any services or research into it really drew me to it, because it was an area where you could really go about making an impact on someone's health by fairly small, maybe not the best areas in health, but you could actually do something to help improve someone's health outcomes. And I found that incredibly rewarding and challenging at the same time.
I think along a similar line, I've been involved with the trans community and being active within the trans community for about 15 years now, just not in my work as a healthcare professional. And I'm really drawn to this area, particularly because there is such a big need for services that are that are for trans and gender diverse people or that are inclusive of the needs of trans and gender diverse people. And I think that working with people through the process of gender affirmation is also incredibly rewarding, and it's amazing to see the difference that it makes to people's lives and their well-being when they're able to access that affirmation.
Great. And that's going to be a big part of your new role at the service, which will be opening in Southeast Sydney Local Health District in coming months. So why do we need affirming specialist health services like the new one that will be opening and T150? And I guess that we know that this group doesn't always have the most positive experiences of accessing healthcare through mainstream services. So what are the unique healthcare needs of this group and what does the research tell us?
Well, I think firstly, I'd just like to acknowledge that the trans and gender diverse people and the trans community have incredible strengths and incredible resilience as well, and bring really important skills and perspectives to healthcare, among other things. But at the same time, there are very specific barriers. Unfortunately, we do still live in a society and a context that has a lot of transphobia and homophobia and other kinds of exclusion, but people really are subject to minority stress and to approaching services that aren't designed to meet their specific needs. We know that people do have higher rates of experiencing different kinds of violence, different kinds of poor outcomes in the community as well, in terms of employment and housing and access to services. And finally, I guess the access to gender affirming treatment has been really, really limited over the past few decades. I think that has slowly been increasing, but there's been no clear pathways for people to access. It's been a very difficult, murky journey where people need to be able to really be a detective and find a thread to follow to access the services that are so desperately needed, and certainly haven't been very many public pathways for that to happen.
And I guess the research, if you don't mind me adding to your answer, so the research, and as Maren said, this is an incredibly strong, resilient community. So we don't want to come from a deficit discourse about this. But when you look at the statistics, trans and gender diverse people face poorer mental health outcomes than any other population or subpopulation group, especially depression, anxiety, self-harm, suicide. So that's the negative side. But the positive side is there is a lot of emerging really decent research which shows if you provide affirming healthcare, now not just hormones, affirming healthcare, just recognizing and respecting someone in their gender identity, their health outcomes, their mental health outcomes, their living outcomes are substantially improved. So the negative side is we've done really poorly, especially in health. We have systemic barriers, we have social barriers, we have personal bias. In healthcare, we've done a really poor job. But the evidence shows that if we do better, the lives of trans and gender diverse people improve greatly.
The Albion Centre has run T150 for a number of years. What are some of the lessons learned from this service?
Yeah. So we opened in, I think it was April 2018. So we're 6 years in, which is amazing in itself for this tiny unfunded service that was kind of underground at first. It's just been so rewarding for all the staff involved. The things we've learned is, and it was started with this and the upcoming other service that we're not naming at this point, are all done with community consultation. And when we were first setting up T150, that was actually a bit of a novel thing in health at the time. But making sure you consult the consumers and the people, you know, as healthcare professionals, we can come up with great ideas, which just people don't want and aren't going to work. So some of the lessons learned were from the start, listening to the clients and the consumers and building a service that would benefit them, that there is not enough money. We do not have enough space, clinicians or funds to do the job we would like to do. You know, the waiting lists, and this isn't just T150, in public sector across Australia, I would say, but I certainly know in New South Wales, the public health services that get set up have waiting lists that just blow out to 6 to 12 months as soon as they're open. So there is a demand there. So the things we've learned is we need more everything, money, clinicians, and it's not through lack of passion and want from the staff working there. It's just we don't have the money, the space to be able to provide it. To do what you do well, we would love to have more counselling and psychosocial support. It is a very medical, nurse-led, but very medical model, and we're aware of that, and that's all we can offer, and we're really honest with people, but we would love to be able to provide more of that support services and just working together. And the other thing you've learned, which Maren touched on and will say throughout, is it's up there with one of the most rewarding parts of my job I do, when it's going well and you bring about a change to someone's life and, you know, support them in their gender, maybe start them on hormones, is just the thing we have learned is you make a difference and you see people just blossom as human beings, which is a lovely thing.
So you were saying there that the specialist services like T150 can have limited capacity. How do we help to promote a no wrong door approach to accessing healthcare for trans and gender diverse folk outside of these specialist services? So through hospitals or GP settings?
Yeah. Good question, Tom. I'd love to say it's simple, but it's not. There's some really big shifts that need to happen in health. The intersectional health needs of this community are great. So whether that is, you know, and not to put it on mental health, but a mental health service or a youth service has a trans person there, how do you link them in with these specialist services that are already have waiting lists and overburdened? No wrong door is us all working together. And I think within certain services, that's not a problem. But as far as the greater health system, I think we have some really big systemic problems. It's like education to healthcare workers is only just starting to pick up as far as hospital systems. And it's not this, once again, most people want to do a good job and the, in quotation marks, the right thing. They just don't know how to address this area. More education and support for healthcare workers, more money, which isn't going to happen, like clearer pathways and really pushing working together and providing high level support, make it visible, talk about it, provide the staff with the education and skills they need to do a decent job and help empower and inform the trans individual that they have rights within the health system, because trans people are amazing at negotiating their way through incredibly difficult situations, but maybe providing more support from the start. That's the public system. What I would eventually love to see, not just a no wrong door, but you mentioned healthcare systems and GPs, is that trans health ends up not being a specialist part of healthcare. You know, it's not rocket science. It's affirming, it's life-saving, absolutely. But general practitioners, I would argue, are actually perfectly positioned to provide trans healthcare. And if you could improve support and education to GPs, you know, they're perfect. They're the ones who should be. It's part of everyday life for these people. So in fact, it probably shouldn't be specialty. What I'd love is, you know, GPs are picking it up and the specialty services see the more complex people. Our specialty services are no longer special. It would be wonderful. We do ourselves out of a job. Bring it on.
And like you were saying, a lot of healthcare workers, you know, do want to do the right thing and be welcoming and affirming. Yeah. So what can we do as healthcare workers or how can we improve our services?
I think, again, a really big part of this is community consultation and co-design or input with consumers and people who will be using the service. We know that there are a few things that do really make a difference. We've had studies that show that some of the most important people in a service are the reception or the admin staff, the people who are greeting the client first and really setting up the expectations for what the service will be like. So I think making sure that everybody is having access to training and education, and I think that needs to be something that's ongoing rather than a one-off sort of tick box training. But yeah, making sure that everybody in the service is having the ability to be trained up and informed and to understand some of the issues that people might be presenting to the service with and how to respond in a way that will be welcoming. Some of those ways would be to ensure that we're offering people the opportunity to introduce themselves using their affirmed name, that we're not forcing people to go by their Medicare name, and that we are introducing ourselves using our pronouns and that we're asking the client's pronouns as well. One of the big problems with our services is we often have forms that don't allow people to identify their, their name or their gender identity. So using a two-step question is really helpful. So asking, what is your gender identity, with space for someone to write free text in that area, and then followed up with what was the sex that was written on your birth certificate or what was the sex assigned or presumed for you at birth. Some of the other things are to have a physical environment where there are physical indicators that it's a safe space. So things like posters or flags, or people can wear pins or brooches, just something that gives a visual indication that, you know, trans people have been thought about and that it is a place where people are making an effort to be welcoming and inclusive of trans people.
Toilets.
Toilets.
Just throw that out there in the middle of a podcast. And, you know, it's always about the toilets, but in all honesty, try and have one. It would be great if they're all gender neutral, but one non-gendered toilet. Often it ends up being the wheelchair or the accessible toilet, which has its problems in itself, but at least one toilet on each floor if you're a multi-floor service where you don't have to pick which bathroom you're going into, because that's incredibly stressful. And it's also really affirming to see that a service or a place does have welcoming public facilities like the bathrooms. I'll just yell toilet out to the microphone randomly.
Like you said, there are a lot of systemic barriers as well. So sometimes these can be our computer systems or how we record things within the system. What solutions are there to these problems?
This is a really difficult one. This is a really big problem that both of our services are negotiating at the moment, I guess, as are the general health services. So you're right, the computer systems that we use now, they don't allow for that to be appropriately recorded in any way. And that really does set us up for the risk of misgendering people, which is either calling people by the wrong name or using the wrong pronoun for people. And that is a really significantly negative experience for most trans and gender diverse people. So it is something that we really want to be able to avoid. Some of the solutions, I guess, what we've been looking for ways that we can record a person's affirmed name, pronouns used, somewhere in the front page of the system so that it is seen at the beginning of the interaction with the person.
There's some inherent problems with public health, which is also if you're doing, let's say, pathology, so if you have to do any testing, that has to be done in a person's, if you want to use Medicare, which most services will otherwise cost a lot, so you need to use the Medicare details, which also includes a gender marker on Medicare. So it's problematic not just with our electronic medical systems that a lot of us use different EMR. There's a statewide one in New South Wales, which isn't at all gender friendly. So yes, you find little workarounds, but there isn't a great big, it opens up and you can see whatever the Medicare details, but their affirmed name and gender. And just recently went and did an in-service at one of the public hospitals in their radiology department. And as Maren said, you poor admin staff, the front of it. So even if they want to do the right thing, the first thing you see is someone's Medicare name pop up and you go into a waiting room and you call that out and people either don't respond or you've already upset them from the start. So changing Medicare is probably a bit beyond all of our abilities, but certainly having a medical record system where you know you need to match things up legally and for costing, but allows the clinicians, the staff, to be able to use the correct name and gender and pronouns for that person. There was a statewide consultation last year looking at improving the statewide electronic medical system. You know, I hope a lot of that comes about. Some of us have been actively agitating for changes for many, many years because it is a problem. They're really small workarounds that we have and they are not perfect. And both Maren and I were talking about this very problem just walking over here today. It's damaging to people, upsetting, and for staff and the patient or the client. So anyone listening, also, you know, agitate, put in some complaints, start getting worked up about it because it's not acceptable. Most of us want to do the right thing and you just can't when you have a system that's forcing you down the wrong lane.
Do you have any stories of individual patients that you'd like to share?
Don't know about individual. I mean, we could, but rather than individual ones, Maren talk, but I'll say, I guess more around affirming healthcare it's incredibly rewarding. And it's also a basic human right to be able to be called your name and gender and, you know, these are human rights we're talking about. So there are so many individuals we have seen come in and I'm sure Maren's the same, that you see before, say, hormones to start on their gender-affirming hormone journey, and you're seeing at their first consult, and they're these terrified things, thinking you're going to be all, like, scary and monsterish, and being able to support them through that process, and then seeing someone a couple of years down the track who, and it's not all rainbows and kittens, it is, you know, there's it's still a journey, there's lots of ups and downs, it's not just a physical change for you on hormones, there's emotional, there's psychosocial, all of it, but you see someone a few years down the track and they are just this new blossomed version of themselves, and it is truly one of the, it's just beautiful. Giving people their first testosterone shot, hey Maren, when they're like, I can feel it straight away, and you're like, I'm pretty sure you can't, but they are so just like, it's wonderful, so excited that you are just supporting them, often on something that they have thought about for a long, long time. And being in the privileged position that we can provide that care. And sometimes it's some of the first, especially healthcare professionals, these people have come to see about it.
Well, we now have a statewide LGBTIQ plus health strategy, which specifically outlines responding to the health needs of trans and gender diverse people in New South Wales and promotes providing gender affirming care. What has been some of the benefits we have seen from this strategy so far?
I don't know if there's been anything, and if any of the big bosses are listening, I apologise now, any big systemic changes that we've seen yet, but I think the level of visibility, even, you know, the different local health districts are now putting together groups to look at, you know, pride groups or supporting communities in all different facets of health, I think is a wonderful move. The fact that New South Wales just last year had its first strategy is interesting, but we are now catching up. So I don't know if the big systemic changes have happened, but there is that push for wider just general education to people and buy-in from people. And seeing like the new statewide services up and the level of interest and support for them, I think that's come about. And on a pure policy support level, it means there's buy-in from people high up in health. And we can all, at grassroots level, try and bring about changes, and we will. Everyone can make an active difference to someone else's life, but to have that high level support actually means there is big buy-in higher up for a long-term change. So little changes, well, not little, but I think over the next few years we'll see that snowball getting bigger and bigger and hopefully bring about some bigger changes.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think having a health strategy developed really legitimizes this area of health as, you know, a focus. We haven't had that before. I think it's really important that we do have a framework. There's, you know, lots of different priority areas in that strategy that we can all work towards. And I think having something there that is in our strategies is really helpful just to guide us and also to really prioritize this area of healthcare.
And I guess looking into the future and some of these changes that might take place, what would a gender-affirming healthcare system look like and what needs to change?
Okay. What would a gender-affirming healthcare system look like? So I think in an ideal world, it would have trans people making the decisions about trans and gender-diverse healthcare. It would have lots of funding for the specific healthcare needs of the community. And it would have systems that were adaptive and responsive to the needs of the community. It would have a workforce that was skilled up and informed and supportive and really wanting to affirm people in whatever their gender identity is. It would be a system that was accountable.
Evidence-based, research-driven, things like your electronic medical record system was adaptable, as Maren said. And I guess we said it before that it's not a specialist area of healthcare, that it's general healthcare. And want to say to anyone listening, you don't have to be an expert in it. That would be one of my dreams. I mean, I'd love everyone just to be accepting of everyone, whatever. But you don't have to understand the full, what's a gender-affirming journey and what are hormones and what does all this mean, but that everyone has a basic understanding so they can show the respect of using a correct name and pronoun and gender, like wherever you are in the healthcare system. So that would be one of my dreams. But yes, that we have got enough money, enough people, enough time to provide the healthcare we'd like to. That would be my dream. And that a trans person can walk into any service and feel welcome and accepted. And it have absolutely nothing to do with trans healthcare, just they're receiving healthcare that is respectful to them as an individual.
And in terms of what needs to change for us to get there, I think there's, you know, there's a lot. We've talked a lot about some of the systemic things that would need to change today. But I think, you know, it's really important that as a community our attitudes are changing, and that biases against trans and gender diverse people are changing, and that the entire health workforce understands that people are the expert in who they are. And if someone comes to you and tells you their gender, their sexuality, their pronouns, there's no need to question that. We need to accept who people are, and we need to support them to be able to live their best life in that identity.
Great. And what resources are there to help people learn more?
Okay, so there's a number of resources. One of the ones that we recommend the most is a website called TransHub. It's an amazing resource. It's full of information about all aspects of trans health, but it goes beyond health as well. So that would be my first recommendation.
Yeah.
It's TransHub.org.
TransHub, which both clinicians and consumers, individuals can access. It's pitched for healthcare workers and population just trying to find out how to access the best healthcare.
In Sydney, we have a number of services that are supporting trans and gender diverse people. So we have the Gender Centre, we have 2010, and we have ACON, and the three of them are amazing resources for our clients, but also they have websites that provide a lot of information as well. There are some e-learning opportunities. There's one that's put out by ASHM and ACON,
yep,
which is a free package that you can sign up for, and it's a self-directed learning package that you can take on.
AusPath, better give AusPath a nudge, Australian Professional Association for Transgender Health, which you can join as a member if you want, but also I'm on the board, so I'm allowed to plug it a bit, but also has the standards of care for provision of gender-affirming hormones. There is a whole pile of healthcare professional support in there as well. It's far more clinical focused than, you know, it's quite doctory, nursey, but it's a great resource as well.
And then I guess zooming out even further, there's WPATH, which is the World Professional Association for Trans Health. They have the Standards of Care 8 published on the website now, and that is an amazing resource because that goes into the evidence base for all of the recommendations about trans health. So if you have any really curly questions about why we do the things that we do, the answers are all in that document.
Great. And I'll link to those resources in the show notes.
The main thing that comes up when healthcare people come and get education is that fear that you're going to do something wrong is probably the thing that I get told or asked about most often. What if I get something wrong? So if you are doing your best and you are sincere and you use the wrong pronoun for someone, apologize and move on. Don't make it a big deal. Don't live in fear that you've done it. Most trans people are pretty good at spotting someone who is trying and new to it and will be understanding. If you do it 20 times over, you know, maybe you need to go back and learn. But don't be so scared of getting everything wrong. What you're doing is basic healthcare. So using someone's name, pronouns, and if you get something wrong, apologize and move on and don't turn it into this big deal. But it's not scary. It's great.
All right, well, thank you very much for being on the podcast today.
Cool.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Sydney Sexual Health Centre podcast, where we've been discussing providing inclusive and person-centred care for transgender and gender-diverse people. To stay up to date with the latest information in sexual health, you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. The information is in the description of the podcast. And if you like the podcast, please share and subscribe.